ranked number 14. The Packers are now tied with Detroit following yesterday's win against the Eagles. The Bears are out of the doghouse for now with a win yesterday against the Vikings. In the NBA, the Bucks beat the Heat 91-84. In the NHL, the Blackhawks over Dallas by a score of 6-2. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Partly sunny and colder today with areas of blowing snow in the afternoon, what with winds out of the west at 10 to 20 miles per hour. Expecting a high today of around 20. Normal high for this time of year is right around 45. For tonight, could see a few flurries flying around late, a low around 9. Then for tomorrow, partly sunny and breezy again. Not much change in temperature of anything. We'll lose a degree or two. Tomorrow's high, just 18. The expanded forecast, along with the cold, comes some light snow on late Tuesday night and into Wednesday. Around 2 inches of accumulation is a possibility. Don't expect anything warmer than the 20s through Friday, but by the weekend, things will start to look up. In fact, by Sunday, forecasters say we should be back in the mid-40s. Right now, 7 degrees in Lake Geneva, 10 degrees in Kenosha. Winds out of the west at 9 miles an hour. The barometer holding steady at 29.83. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The morning show with Greg Berg is coming up. Support for WGTD's morning show comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation. Designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to Monday's morning show here on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We will be talking on today's morning show about one of the most beautiful creatures on the face of the earth, the jaguar. And we're going to be doing so because of a lovely and interesting, intriguing new book called An Indomitable Beast, The Remarkable Journey of the Jaguar. My guest is Alan Rabinowitz, who is CEO of a nonprofit called Panthera, which dedicates itself to saving wild cats like the jaguar. And Mr. Rabinowitz has also served as executive director of the Science and Exploration Division and Big Cat Programs of the Wildlife Conservation Program. He's written a number of different books. In fact, I spoke with him about a lovely children's book of his called A Boy and a Jaguar, in which he recounted his experience as someone with a serious stuttering problem, and someone who found himself as a boy identifying in some very powerful ways with the jaguar. And it was ultimately through some of his efforts to speak on behalf of jaguars that he began to find himself able to, at least to an extent, conquer this lifelong problem with stuttering. And so it was on sort of two different levels, a very interesting and inspiring story. And now he goes further with this brand new book again called An Indomitable Beast, The Remarkable Journey of the Jaguar, in which we find out more about the jaguar and about Alan Rabinowitz's efforts to help us better understand this creature and how we can help preserve this beautiful creature from extinction. Alan Rabinowitz, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
So good to be talking with you once again. And I'm struck by, again, how personal this book is and how movingly you recount so much of your own life's journey. Tell our listeners about the book's prologue and an experience that you recount which dates back to when you were just 5 years old.
Well, I was born with a debilitating stutter. I never remember as a child being able to utter a complete sentence. In fact, I never remember being able to utter more than a complete sentence until I was a senior in college. But as a young child, I had learned that while the world didn't understand me, didn't want to look beyond the stutter, because back then in the New York City school system, they didn't quite know how to deal with stuttering. They didn't know how to deal with a lot of things like dyslexia and ADHD and even certain types of autism. Any child that wasn't normal was put into these special classes, classes which the other children would make fun of and call the retarded classes. So I was viewed as, in my child's mind, I was viewed as broken by adults. So I considered myself broken. And after a while, I just didn't even think I should keep on trying to convince people I was otherwise, even though in my own head, I was normal. I would be getting good grades. I could excel in sports and class. But just because I didn't have a normal human voice, the human world saw me as something outside of their realm. But I learned early that I could talk to animals and be myself. A lot of the psychological tension went away. Animals had no expectation of me. Animals didn't judge me. Animals just let me be. They could feel. They had a consciousness. I realized that even as a young child. Whether they could understand my words or not wasn't important. They could understand my feelings. So I would talk to animals like my pet turtles and my hamsters and my snakes and my gerbils. But if I had bad days, my father would take me to the Bronx Zoo because he knew that I loved being surrounded by the animals at the zoo and I could wander by myself and talk to them. And the one place I loved more than any other was what was called the Lion House. We called it the Big Cat House because it had cage after cage of tigers and snow leopards and lions. And these animals were big and they were strong and they were healthy, and yet they were locked inside these little concrete cages the way I felt I was locked inside my own head. They were normal. They were healthy like me. But because they didn't have a human voice, I realized even at the age of six, they were locked in these cages simply because they didn't have a human voice. I doubt we would even have most animals in zoos today if they had a human voice and could say, I don't want to be here, or I'm lonely, I'm sad, I'm sick. Simply because of that, one animal always attracted me more than any other of the big cats, that there was only one cage with one lone jaguar in it. And while all the other big cats would charge at the bars and roar and make vocalizations and entertain the people, this jaguar would sit in a corner or maybe sit high on a shelf it had and just watch. Just watch the people as if it was judging them instead of it being the one inside of a cage. It looked out at you as if you were in the cage. And I would stand by that cage, and I would whisper to that jaguar, waiting for the time when all the people around me were gone and I'd be alone with that animal, and eventually it would come towards me and come by the bars. And I would talk to it, and I would tell it my dreams and my hopes, and I would tell it how people were stupid, I believe, because they thought I was stupid. But I would always, I would never leave that cage and never leave that cat house without promising to that jaguar or to the other cats there that if I ever found my voice one day, I would try to be their voice.
Hmm.
I would give them what I knew they could never have, which is a human voice. I hoped that I would find my voice, because as a child, I had no idea why I stuttered or how it could be cured, if it could be. But if I could find my voice, I would try to speak for them.
Hmm.
And I never forgot that promise.
In addition to writing about that encounter with the jaguar in the Bronx Zoo and other animals, you also do talk in the first chapter about how you felt a very important connection to those pets you had at home. You write, "My companions, a little menagerie of chameleons, green turtles, garter snakes, and hamsters, were the only living beings around me that seemed to listen but not judge. They had feelings, but they too had no voice to express themselves. They were me." You tell us that in the summer before your last year of college, your parents told you about an experimental clinic for severe stutterers that was in upstate New York. And you describe yourself after some work there as becoming what you call a fluent stutterer. Tell us what that term means, to be a fluent stutterer.
Well, what we had to learn right off the bat, you have to realize that at that time when I was young, it was quite a while ago, and there were no computers. You couldn't get onto the internet and learn about who else was out there who might stutter or who offered help in stuttering. There were very, very few books written on stuttering. It's a very misunderstood or little understood aspect of speech pathology even today, because now we know that it has a genetic physiological component as well as a psychological component, whereas in the past it was thought to be purely psychological. But back then, every stutterer always thought that maybe there was a way to cure it. I mean, people as well, adults also did. I went to hypnotists. I even had shock therapy to my brain because they thought maybe they could reset the brain. And in my most frustrating hours, I would actually go as far as to hit my own head against a wall, literally bash my head into a wall, not to try to hurt myself, but to think that maybe I could reset my own head. That's how bad it got and how little we knew about it. But at this clinic, before they knew that it was actually a neurological impairment, the people teaching this clinic said, "One thing you have to face, for whatever reason, you're never going to be a non-stutterer. If you're a true stutterer, you are born a stutterer, and you will always be a stutterer. But we can teach you techniques, manipulations of your mouth that come into play when the stuttering happens that will enable you to speak fluently, to move through the stuttering. And if you really perfect it, nobody will even think that you say, you will still stutter. You will always be a stutterer. But you can be a completely fluent stutterer." And I'm doing that now. I mean, even now, I'm not in full control mode, because that's very difficult. What it is they would teach you how to manipulate the hard contacts. When you stutter, your tongue gets locked against your upper palate, or your lips get locked together if you're trying to spit out a B, or the back of your throat starts to constrict the airflow. These techniques taught you to relax your muscles whenever that starts to occur and to actually let the words go out. So if I go into full control, like I'm doing right now, and you might have heard no difference whatsoever, but this is very difficult for me. Right now I'm thinking completely about where the parts of my mouth are as I'm talking to you, So I have to think about how I'm saying each word while I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to be saying. If I do this, I can't stutter. I can't, because I'm not letting the hard contacts happen. But it's also unbelievably difficult. It just takes a huge amount out of me. I can't do this full time. So I'll go into kind of a partial mode. Now I'll get out of it, and I'll go faster, and I'll speak more normally, but I'll get caught sometimes. You will hear small stuttering of mine, but now I've done this for so many years, I can move through those stuttering blocks. But a lot of people couldn't do that. There was a high rate of recidivism because you needed to practice this for years, not just hours, but years and years till you could get good at it.
As you describe in this paragraph, there is no magic pill. And it took incredible concentration and work, and still does to this day. I'm curious about something else that you mention in passing in this chapter, where you talk about, you know, this really rough childhood which you experienced. You mentioned that your dad was a PE teacher, and that he taught you both to box and to wrestle. As soon as I read those words, I sort of expected that you were going to go right on to say that that then as a young man, you know, maybe in junior high and high school, then, you know, you probably struggled in all kinds of other areas, but there was this place of, you know, the wrestling mat or the boxing ring where you could taste success, and it was, you know, in a sense of a source of salvation for you. But you really don't go on to say any of that. And I'm just curious, was that an arena where you could taste some success? Or I mean, because I think we've heard stories like that quite a lot. Or for some reason, was that just not all that positive an experience for you, or restorative in the sense that we might assume it to be?
Well, that's a terrific question, because it is something that I don't deal with much, because it's not associated with a lot of wonderful memories. It actually was a source. It was cathartic for me, but not always pleasant. My father built a gym in our own house, so there was a punching bag in the basement and weights, and I was big into weights and boxing as well as wrestling. And in those days, the punching bags weren't leather and vinyl, they were canvas. And to try to explain how cathartic, when I had bad days, my father would take me down, we would box, he'd let me get my frustration out. But I didn't want to be confrontational. I didn't want to hurt somebody else. I wanted to hurt myself. I wanted to get the pain came out by me giving myself pain. So that bag, and I almost wish I'd saved it. Instead, I got rid of it when my father died. That canvas bag was actually splattered with red dots with my own blood, because I would punch that bag bare-fisted when I had bad days until my knuckles were raw and bled. I had no desire to fight other people and beat up. I was in a lot of fights back then, but I never started fights. I would just never run from fights. And if somebody made fun of me, but I had no desire to hurt someone else. The pain for me was on me. And wrestling was the same. I was a good wrestler. I ended up winning a lot of matches because I had so much anger in me, but I never wanted to hurt somebody. So the catharsis came more with me being alone, me ending up going adventure, trying to climb rocks, jumping out of an airplane when I was young. I tried to do everything I could that would test the limits of my physical ability in order to compensate for what I saw as deficient in my other side of not being able to be a full human being.
Now, you
able to talk to girls.
Yeah. Well, you ended up experiencing tremendous success in the sciences. You tell us, even back in high school and certainly in college, you took all the science that you could and ultimately ended up graduating summa cum laude in both biology and chemistry. What do you think it was about the sciences that was so appealing to you, and something in which you could be so tremendously successful. What about the sciences?
The sciences, as a young person and even to this day, appealed to me tremendously because to me, they represented truths to absolute. Now I know better now, but they represented absolute truths outside of the world of human beings. In other words, rules and laws that were out there whether humans existed or not. It compensated for my feeling that I was terribly wronged by the human race, by people judging me, people creating my world or trying to create a world for me which wasn't my world because of the way they were simply seeing me. And they were wrong. I knew that they were wrong, but I had to live by the rules of these adults and humans. Science seemed to me to be everything outside of the human world. If every human disappeared, those laws, the laws of gravity, would still exist. So I was tremendously attracted to the purity, what I considered at the time the purity of science, because it was something that took me away from the human world.
Hmm. Interestingly, one of the first important expeditions you undertook involved being employed by the Bronx Zoo, that place that had been so important to you in your childhood. And this expedition took you to the beautiful country of Belize. Tell us about this and tell us how important this was for all that followed.
Well, I would say it really makes me believe in fate, because who could have imagined that being at the Bronx Zoo as a child, talking to that jaguar in a cage, would eventually come full circle without any real connections in between to me end up being back as an employee of the Bronx Zoo, saving the big cats. But I was in graduate school in Tennessee, studying in the new field of wildlife ecology, animal ecology, zoology, and I was actually studying black bears and raccoons in the Smoky Mountains. I was capturing bears, I was radio collaring them, living in the Smoky Mountains, following them. It was one of the best times of my life because I was alone in the wild and I felt at peace. And I came into contact with a man who was to become my lifelong friend and mentor, who now works with me, Dr. George Schaller, who at the time ran the International Conservation Program at the Bronx Zoo. And he was coming down to Tennessee because he was in China studying giant pandas, and I and my cohorts were studying black bears in the Smokies, which he considered similar to giant panda habitat in China. Make a long story short, I was asked to take this man into the Smoky Mountains hiking. I can't even say we got along. We actually argued the entire time. We parted ways, and the next thing I know, I'm getting a phone call from my major professor asking me if I want to go to this little-known country of Belize, which at the time I had not heard of, nobody had heard of, because it had been British Honduras and had just gotten its independence as Belize. This is now 1980, and do a survey on jaguars. Without even knowing where the country was, I said, absolutely, tell him I will go. And I was sent to this little country of Belize, which had just turned from British Honduras, because George, who was working on jaguars at the time in Brazil, was reading that there were jaguars everywhere in this tiny country. Even though they were being killed, they seemed to be everywhere, even coming into the capital city of Belize City. And he wanted me to go look at what was happening. And that was the start of my lifelong career. He asked me to do a two-week survey. I didn't come back for 6 weeks. Then I ended up going back for several years, which led to setting up the world's first jaguar preserve.
Hmm. We're speaking with Alan Rabinowitz, and we're talking about his book called An Indomitable Beast, The Remarkable Journey of the Jaguar. You actually have been interested in a lot of the so-called big cats of the world, and In fact, you tell us for a time focused your energies actually more on the tiger than the jaguar, which it seemed like ultimately just sort of reinforced your special affection for and concern for the jaguar. In fact, you say one thing at one point that I think is really intriguing. You write, "What I had seen in my work with the tiger made me worry all the more about the jaguar." Tell us about that, about how studying the tiger and the way in which it was endangered, in a sense, brought you back to the jaguar and enhanced your worry about it.
Well, I had lived for over a decade in Asia by that time. It was the late 1990s, and I was living and working in Thailand on the Thai-Burmese border. I was surveying tigers and trying to save them throughout much of Indochina, part of China into Burma, and it was what I was seeing was devastating. I thought that this was going to be a horrifically difficult battle, and we'd already lost most of the war, and it was not because these cats. And here we're talking about the tiger, probably the most recognizable animal by school children of any wild animal in the world, lauded by companies and by people, and yet we were letting and are still letting it basically slide towards extinction. One of the most iconic species on Earth, which we could easily save, but we're just not putting the care and the resources and people behind saving it. And at the time, I realized this could be the way of the jaguar. The jaguar was being largely ignored after I had done my studies and set up the first preserve, partly because people said, well, there's still plenty of habitat. There's still plenty of jaguars out there. Jaguars are doing pretty well, so we don't have to really work at saving them, something I have to deal with even to this day. So I realized that we actually knew very little. After George Schaller's work and my own work on jaguars and some other people, we still knew very little about jaguars. So I left studying tigers, although I still do that. I was doing both at the same time, and I came back into the jaguars' world thinking, no, I can't leave this to the world. The world fails miserably at doing good conservation. Even today, conservation is almost a hobby horse for the human race. We see it as a side thing that when we have a little extra money, a little extra time, we'll splatter it among saving a few animals. And it's a terrible mistake for the human race. But beyond that, it's helping a lot of these incredibly iconic species, rhinos, elephants, tigers, and jaguars, slide towards extinction. So I was going to fight that. If I couldn't work on save every animal, I was going to at least save the animal of my childhood that was the jaguar. And we still had a great chance because there was still enough jaguars out there and enough land for them, and that's why I came back.
In the second chapter of the book, you, among other things, take a few pages to sketch what we know, at least, about the origins of the jaguar. And that's a story that takes us far back into history, although I think you tell us that in some respects the emergence of the so-called big cats are relatively recent events compared to other kinds of creatures. Nevertheless, it's kind of a complex history, and one that has more than a couple of unanswered questions in it.
Huge amounts of unanswered questions. Nobody can even tell you when jaguars first evolved. Nobody can even tell you when the first real cat evolved. We do know, I mean, the Earth is supposed to be about 4.5 billion years, well, life on Earth about 4.5 billion years old. We think that the first cat-like animal came about only about 25 or 30 million years ago. Some people speculate that the first big cat, the first panthera, came about 8 to 9 million years ago. But in actuality, a lot of this is speculation, is actually guesswork, because we have very, very few fossils. The fossil record of the big cats is incredibly sparse.
Could I ask you about that? I'm just curious. Is there a particular reason why that should be? Why the fossil record for the big cats is so sparse? Is there something about what their skeletons were like or where they lived that there is such scant fossil evidence of them?
Well, that's a very good question. It's not because it doesn't have anything to do with their bones, with their anatomy. What is speculated is that the cats went through such massive diversification very, very quickly. Fossil records are usually more rich when an animal's been around for a long time and has slowly evolved over time, over large areas. The cats have been around for a relatively short amount of time, and they believe they diversified through the Pleistocene and other big climatic changes very, very quickly. And because they diversified quickly over a short amount of time, there isn't really a rich fossil record. There are probably beds of fossils that we haven't discovered yet. The newest big cat fossil was just discovered last year in 2014 up in Tibet. So part of it is we don't know where to look even. We haven't even been agreement on where some of these cats have first evolved. Why we know so much about certain species is because people have found rich fossil beds in certain places. But the big cats seem to have evolved up in the Tibet area, up in the Himalayas. And we just haven't found a lot of fossils.
You do tell us that the jaguar has been in places around the world that it really isn't found now. Where are the places where jaguars once lived and have essentially vanished, and where do jaguars live now?
Well, it seems the earliest evidence we've got of jaguars is what's called the Pleistocene jaguar. The Pleistocene jaguar seems to have evolved, according to what evidence we've got, somewhere around south of the Caspian Sea. That's the area of modern-day Iran. And during the Pleistocene, when all those ice ages were occurring, 18 of them actually, the jaguar did what is one of its major behaviors that allows it to survive. It moves. It moves over large areas trying to get away from big climatic fluctuations or big environmental disturbances. So the jaguar moved from the southern part of the Caspian Sea, somewhere in modern-day Iran, through what's known as modern-day Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, and then up into Russia, and all the way through Russia until it hit what became the Bering Strait during one of the interglacial times, this land connection between the old world and the new world. Now, during the middle of the Pleistocene, this Pleistocene jaguar went extinct. But by the time it did go extinct, along with 80% of all the other big cats in the world, the jaguar had made it already over into the new world, into North America, what we think of as Canada and down into the United States. And that became another kind of jaguar. That became the Pleistocene jaguar of North America.
One of the most interesting things you say about this is something which seems to correspond with a change in habitat. You write, as its cooler, more open habitats were replaced with warmer forests, the jaguar became smaller in size, with a corresponding shortening of the limbs. You go on to say that we sort of talk about this or can come to understand this through something called Bergman's rule. Of the many interesting things in your book, this is one of my favorites. Can you talk a moment about this shift in the size of the jaguar and how the matter of climate and habitat seems to have had something to do with that.
Yes. Well, if you think about it, it actually makes completely logical sense. If you the jaguar originally, as well as many other big cats or other large carnivores of the time, was not a warm climate jungle species. It was a colder higher elevation species, and the original jaguar, the European jaguar that went extinct, was about 1.5 to 2 times the size of the largest modern day jaguars. Now, even today, you go from north until south, from the colder areas into warmer climates, and you find changes in body size generally, from larger body size to smaller body size. And the reason, and that's part of Bergman's rule, the reason for that, if you think about it, is if you're in a cold environment, one of the best ways to maintain your internal body core temperature, if you're a warm-blooded species, if you're a mammal, would be to have a large body with as little surface area as possible, so that the heat dissipates less. And as you go into warmer climates, you want the heat to be able to dissipate faster. So you want the surface area, the outside of the body, relative to the internal body, to be larger than in colder climates. Does that make sense?
It does. But it's also the kind of thing I don't think it would ever occur to us that such a thing could happen.
And that's also, it's really an interesting thing. And that's why, let's take mountain lions. A lot of people in the United States are familiar with the mountain lions. The largest mountain lions on record are not the ones in the Neotropics. They're the ones in the United States, in North America. The larger mountain lions are the ones in the colder areas of the Northwest United States. As you go down south through the mountain lion range all the way into Argentina, they get much, much smaller.
In Chapter 3, of course, the figure of man enters the picture, enters the world of the jaguar, so to speak. And, of course, it's easy for us to understand now how man threatens the jaguar and other big cats just by us encroaching on their habitat, and to say nothing of barbaric poaching and so on. But, of course, you're spelling a very, or describing a very long view of this, and the fact that even very primitive man, of course, was a very direct threat to the jaguar. Tell us sort of trace the history of this, if you would.
Well, part of why, what's interesting, some people ask, why is it jaguars are not more aggressive towards human beings? Because of all the big cats, jaguars, though they're the third largest cat in the world, largest in the Western Hemisphere, they're the least aggressive cats towards human beings. And where humans live around jaguars, they're generally not afraid of jaguars, not like where they live near tigers and lions and leopards. And in history, tigers, lions, leopards have killed hundreds of thousands of people. Even mountain lions have killed scores of human beings. Jaguars have never been known to become a man-eater, and our knowledge of how many people they have killed doesn't go beyond about a dozen or so. Some of the speculation of why this is, where it originated, is because it seems that jaguars don't have a long history with prehistoric man, with ancient man. Man came onto the scene, human beings only came onto the scene of Europe in the mid-Pleistocene as the jaguar there was going extinct. They then followed the jaguar's path across Beringia into North America about 1 million years after the jaguar had already arrived and already spread down into Central and South America. So the interactions, we have very little evidence. The earliest evidence of human beings and jaguars even in the same place are skeletons of them together in a cave in Texas, which is dated somewhere 4,000 to 11,000 years ago. It's that recently. That's the only evidence we've got of any kind of possible early encounter between man and jaguars. So much of the dynamic between all of the dynamic between humans and jaguars is actually a very recent event.
Hmm. And of course, very much to the disadvantage of the jaguar.
Yes. Before
your efforts, what are we talking about in terms of how dire the circumstances surrounding the jaguar? How endangered, at the worst, has the jaguar been? How close to extinction?
Things were getting very bad starting in the 1960s. In the 1960s, interestingly, this is another interesting story in the book that most people aren't aware. Completely without knowing it, Jacqueline Kennedy came out wearing a leopard coat, a spotted cat coat, which was legal at the time, and it started a fashion craze, which just spiraled out of control for spotted cat furs. Now, we see this even today, but today it's faux fur, which is good. But back then, it was real fur. And from the 1960s into the 70s and extending into even the 80s, when it was becoming illegal, the fashion industry was responsible for almost the wiping out of jaguars and many other spotted cats, because now these animals had a big bullseye on them. They had a price tag on them. This is similar to why tigers are so endangered, because tigers are so highly valued by the Chinese medicinal trade. So it's worth going after every single individual. This is what occurred at one time starting in the 60s with the jaguars. And they were being literally wiped out, and it was legal to kill them at the time. The numbers got to be so low of jaguars, they were becoming so sparse, that it finally spurred countries in Central and South America to enact laws that made jaguar hunting illegal and to actually start to set up some protected areas. But we don't know how low the numbers actually were, but they were literally at the high point of the fashion industry, hundreds of thousands of skins coming into the ports of the United States and Europe, hundreds of thousands of spotted cat skins, not just jaguar, but ocelot and some of the other cat species, but mostly jaguar. So it was becoming extremely rare for anybody to see or find a jaguar. Mm. And if anybody saw a jaguar track, they would immediately go after it because it was very valuable.
Right. Your book focuses in large measure on some of your most recent efforts on behalf of the jaguar to help preserve it, and in a couple of different ways. I wish we had longer to kind of explore this. We'll leave it to our listeners, of course, to secure your book and read about all of the fascinating details. But one of the things you talk about in this book is when you began to understand how new research about the DNA of the jaguar could actually be very significant in helping to ensure its survival. What was your main realization on this point?
In 1999, I decided to call a meeting of all known jaguar experts. It wasn't many. It was less than two dozen. And we met outside of Mexico City to try to determine what our state of knowledge was for the jaguar. What did we know? What did we not know? What I was expecting was that we would try to start getting at where the last few good populations of jaguars were scattered over two continents, and I would try to start a program which was triage, of just trying to save the best out there to be saved. As a result of that meeting, This was not an epiphany on my part. This was serendipity. As a result of bringing scientists together with their most recent research, there was a group of geneticists who had started using a brand new genetic technique of extracting DNA from fecal matter. And they were looking at the different jaguars from Mexico to Argentina to try to determine how many races there might be to assist us in knowing where the most important populations were. If there were different races, we wanted to save samples of every kind of race. What their research ended up showing, much to my shock and everybody's, was that there were no races, that there was no difference. They didn't even realize the implications of what that meant. To me, it blew me away. What that meant was that if you look at a map of jaguar range, these patches of jaguars in protected areas, somehow there were individuals sneaking out like the Underground Railway of the Civil War, finding their way through the human landscape between populations over two continents. And they were maintaining genetic continuity throughout the whole range from Mexico to Argentina. It's not like one jaguar was walking from Mexico to Argentina. Individual jaguars were moving just like they had done in the Pleistocene in order to save themselves from extinction. This is what I didn't tie together until I wrote the book. This behavior had been there since the Pleistocene. They were moving through what we deemed inhospitable habitat, through cattle ranches, citrus groves, swimming the Panama Canal. They were going where we didn't think they could go, but they had been doing this since the Pleistocene, and they had found their own way. Once I learned that, then I realized I had been way off base. It was not about looking where the best populations were. It was about helping the jaguar do what it was doing on its own, and that's maintaining a contiguous corridor, a genetic corridor, throughout its entire range from Mexico to Argentina.
In other words, making it possible or making it more possible for the jaguar to make these journeys and for these corridors to be established where they didn't really exist and for them to be safeguarded, too.
That's right. And I didn't have to do this for them. They were doing it. It wasn't a matter of me making corridors for the jaguars. It was a matter of me finding where the genetics showed they were doing this. I just had to figure out where they were doing it and try to save those corridors in each country and let the jaguar be a jaguar.
Mm. It's an amazing story. And, of course, one of the things I especially appreciate is that you explore the science of this in such interesting detail. You also explore the sort of the politics that are involved and the negotiations, sometimes very delicate, that are involved in trying to foster cooperation where maybe there might not be much, and to help ensure that this beautiful, beautiful animal is going to be with us for a long, long time to come. The book again is called An Indomitable Beast: The Remarkable Journey of the Jaguar. It's published by Island Press. The book includes some very interesting photos, several of which are absolutely gorgeous, and just underscore all the more the majesty of the jaguar. And the author, Alan Rabinowitz. Alan Rabinowitz, I am so grateful for this opportunity to speak with you once again, and certainly am grateful to you for all the good work that you are doing on behalf of the jaguar and other creatures. And I wish you well with all of your efforts and appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. It's been a pleasure.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Professor Art Sear from Carthage College pays his monthly visit to the program to offer his analysis of current events. On Wednesday, Jeffrey Darman, the author of a fascinating new book called Landslide, which examines the period of 1964 to 1966, which was a crucial time in the presidency of Lyndon Baines Johnson, a period which began with enormous promise, but which ultimately led to the beginning of his political decline. Those 2 years also saw the beginning of the political rise of Ronald Reagan.